It's official. The Glendale City Council has approved a 2-year arena management deal with the Coyotes. But why would the team sign on?
The real crystallizing moment for us was the day that we signed Mikhail Bodker, and he would only go as far as a 1-year deal. We got together as an ownership group and said, this is not the way we can run a hockey team.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the silver anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, options to pay for needed transportation projects.
And storytelling goes old school.
People can feel that they've spent too much time in front of a screen. And I think it has created a need for us to join with other people face-to-face and hear about their lives.
Plus, buying the ranch and the Mercury's going up.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Friday afternoon traffic, pretty light so far. There is one fairly serious accident, though. On the 60 eastbound at McClintock Drive, you'll not be able to get off the freeway. The off-ramp is blocked. Valley weather for tonight, we have partly cloudy skies expected with lows in the mid-80s. Then for this weekend, partly cloudy skies both Saturday and Sunday with highs around 106. Currently with relative humidity at 23%, it's 99 degrees.
Growing competition in the Valley's restaurant scene has pushed a popular local chain into bankruptcy. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, Z Tejas Southwestern Grill is hoping the court will allow it to be sold.
Roughly 18 different entities related to the Z Tejas restaurant chain filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection this week, including the entity that owns the popular Taco Guild restaurant in Central Phoenix. Z Tejas' CEO said in court papers that the company is facing more than $9 million in debt and has suffered from industry competition and consumer spending that still hasn't recovered. The company hopes to keep its restaurants open through a buyout, which could happen in September when it's scheduled to go to auction. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
The Glendale City Council voted unanimously this morning on a new agreement with the Arizona Coyotes. The deal will end a lawsuit between the two parties that was filed after the council voted to terminate the previous contract 6 weeks ago. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan has been following the issue and is here with me. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Mark.
So what is the new deal?
Well, the new deal is for 2 years, so it'll expire in June of 2017, and there are two big changes. The first change is how the money changes hands between the city and the ICE Arizona, which owns the Coyotes and manages Gila River Arena. It used to be that the city would pay $15 million to ICE Arizona, and then ICE Arizona would pay a certain amount of that back to the city and revenues generated by parking and other kinds of fees. Now, the city will just pay $6.5 million annually, a flat rate, to the company to manage the arena. The second change is the deal requires the Coyotes to terminate their general counsel and former city attorney Craig Tindall, who went to work for the Coyotes in 2013, shortly after the deal was signed. And it stipulates that they can't hire Julie Frazzoni, another former city employee. And those two individuals were actually cited as the reason the city broke the contract 6 weeks ago.
The Coyotes were upset when the city voted to void the contract back in June. So why did they go ahead and sign this new one?
So co-owner of the Coyotes, Anthony LeBlanc, said at the meeting that the team needed certainty to build a roster. And once he realized that the uncertainty was affecting his ability to recruit players, he knew he had to come to a settlement to provide some kind of permanency for the team.
The real crystallizing moment for us was the day that we signed Mikhail Bodker, and he would only go as far as a 1-year deal. We got together as an ownership group and said, this is not the way we can run a hockey team.
So the deal is only until 2017. Does that mean the team could potentially move in a couple of years?
Co-owner LeBlanc said the Coyotes wanted a longer deal, but he assured fans the hockey team is planning to stay in Glendale. He said that, you know, the team could have left this summer if they wanted. They had to clear out, no consequences for leaving, but they decided to stay. Mayor of Glendale, Jerry Weyer, says he's happy with the length. He says it gives the parties more time to negotiate a more longer-term agreement.
I think everybody's getting hung up on a 2-year deal. The 2-year deal simply allows us time to work this out in the future. There's not a council member that doesn't want the Coyotes to stay here. We all do. We need a situation that benefits all of us.
Wires mentioned that the decision to cancel the contract 6 weeks ago was purely a business decision because the city needed some certainty for their budget, and this allows them to plan for the future.
KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan. Alex, thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks. Salt River Project has broken ground on a new solar power plant in Florence. The utility says the Sandstone Solar Project will produce 45 megawatts once it's done. That'd power roughly 8,000 homes. Lori Singleton is director of SRP's Emerging Customer Programs.
One of the things that we have found and found with this project is the price of solar has continued to decrease, so much so that this was a very affordable project for SRP to invest in on behalf of all of our customers. And so that was one of the contributing factors. I'd say another factor is the fact that we do have renewable energy goals, and we try and implement resources into that portfolio that are cost-effective and reliable for SRP customers.
Does it seem like this is the kind of solar project that SRP will be looking at going forward as opposed to trying to increase its rooftop solar?
I think SRP will continue. One of our very specific goals has been to implement renewable energy at the lowest price possible for SRP customers. And so as we continue to see the price of large-scale solar plants go down, I think you'll continue to see SRP investing in these types of projects.
Other than cost, are there other advantages to doing it this way, sort of this large scale, as opposed to more residential stuff?
I think one of the things that you see with a large-scale solar plant is the ability to produce more energy, because that facility and those solar panels do track the sun. As well, there are economies of scale when you think about large-scale solar plants and purchasing the equipment for a larger plant. It does allow for efficiencies and price reductions that you might not see with other types of solar projects.
Do you have a sense yet of where this power will ultimately be used?
Yes, the power just feeds into SRP's grid, much like any of our other resources, and then it is just distributed out to all our customers, you know, as a piece of the overall electricity that they consume.
Do you have plans currently for any other large-scale plants like this one?
We don't have any plans announced or at this time, we currently don't have another project that's been announced.
When you're looking at siting these plants, how much of an issue is like availability of land, and can we buy the land, and is it affordable to buy this land, or do we already own it, or something like that?
You know, all of that plays into the price that a developer is able to offer solar to a utility, because we are actually buying the output of the electricity from the developer, and then we in turn just put that in our portfolio as resources for our customers. So land costs, the price of the panels, the efficiency of the panels, all of that, the permitting, all of that plays into whether or not a solar plant makes sense, and you know, for both SRP and the customer.
Lori Singleton is director of SRP's Emerging Customer Programs. Lori, thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I'm happy to be a guest on your show.
Sunday marks 25 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The law prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities and requires new buildings to conform to accessibility standards, among other provisions. We're going to hear two perspectives on this anniversary, starting with Dot Neri. She advocated for the ADA leading up to its passage and is now an assistant research professor at the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at the University of Kansas. And Dot, what do you think the ADA has achieved?
I think the biggest thing it's done is to raise awareness of how people with disabilities have often been left out of society, not accommodated, and therefore don't have the quality of life that other people in the U.S. do. Now ADA, people recognize it, they know what it means, they don't always agree with it or follow it, but when you mention ADA, people know immediately this has to do with rights and inclusion and access for people with disabilities. I think that has been a tremendous benefit of this legislation.
When you were working to try to get it passed, was that what you hoped it would achieve?
Yes, I had hoped that I would be validated as an American citizen with rights by this legislation. And that has happened.
Are there any areas in which you think the ADA has sort of fallen short of expectations or aspirations?
Well, as with any civil rights law, the difficult part is enforcement. There is no ADA police. There's nobody who goes around checking things and, you know, making people comply. Really, It's the people with disabilities in their own community working with governmental entities, businesses, all sorts of ways that it is enforced. But the ADA is much more than physical access. It's about interpreters for people who are deaf and want to attend a school board meeting. It's about people who have low vision having materials available in large print. It really is a comprehensive law, but we really have a lot more to do to make sure that people comply with it.
Do you think the ADA as it is sufficient for where we are now? Do you think it needs to be adjusted or tweaked in some way going forward?
Well, the first thing we need to do is not to have it weakened, because there have been efforts to weaken the ADA. When you pass a law, you know, there's always compromises. I would like maybe more emphasis on remediating older buildings, even though it can be expensive. Not to put people out of business, but to recognize that their business is enhanced if they can have more customers. And giving the number of people living with disabilities increasing access makes sense for everybody. So I guess I would focus first on enforcement of the law we have, rather than figuring out new ways to enhance it. I think that we talk about the ADA as a benefit for people with disabilities. Really, it is aimed at creating environments in the society that works for everybody. So the ADA has wonderful things. We do have more things to do, but I would celebrate the ADA as a wonderful tool to start building the type of society we need to create that accommodates everybody.
Dot Neri is an assistant research professor at the Research and Training Center on Independent Living at the University of Kansas. Dot, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Phil Pangrazio is president and CEO of the Arizona Bridge to Independent Living. He suffered a severe spine injury more than 35 years ago. He says the ADA's impact has been far-reaching.
Well, I think first and foremost, what the ADA did was really raise the consciousness of the American public about disability rights issues, and that it really is a civil rights issue. Up until that time, I don't think it was really on the radar screen of the American public. And by doing so, I think there was more acceptance of, you know, we need to make this country more accessible to people with disabilities, and that it was the right thing to do and we need to do it. You know, prior to the ADA, there were lots of little mini steps taken. There were a lot of little laws, you know, not little laws, but there were a lot of laws created. You know, Architectural Barriers Act of 1968 and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act of 1975. All these little steps that were being taken to make and make improvements for people with disabilities and to make it possible, you know, that we would be able to participate in our communities and in society. But what the ADA did was really bring it all together and then, of course, put it on the radar screen for people.
How much of a difference has it made in employment situations?
Well, employment still is a big issue for people with disabilities. The unemployment rate is double that of non-disabled people, and that just includes the folks that are looking for work. Yeah. And doesn't include folks that have given up looking for work, which if we include that, the unemployment rate probably is close to 70% for people with disabilities. So it's an area that really still needs a lot of work, I think. But again, I think employers are thinking they're trying to do more to make it possible for people with disabilities to be employed. And certainly there's a lot of effort by government to encourage this. And so that, I think, is a positive thing. But it does involve attitudinal change. And that's another thing that the ADA did, is that it did change attitudes both by, you know, the private sector or business community, but also by people with disabilities. We needed to change attitude amongst ourselves to, you know, say, okay, you know, jobs just aren't free. We need to actually go out and perform. And people with disabilities can perform and do perform. But again, we probably need to improve those opportunities.
So where do we go from here? Is there receptiveness to do more? And I mean more in a real official way. Maybe it doesn't have to be as large and impactful as the ADA, but the idea that
even as we talked about, there are other steps that can be taken.
Probably the three biggest issues will continue to be employment, housing, accessible and affordable housing, and transportation. So those three things will always kind of, everything kind of centers around that. And because if we improve in those three areas, we're going to make it more possible for people with disabilities to be contributing members of our communities.
Philip Pangrazio, President and CEO of the Arizona Bridge to Independent Living. Still to come, the gas tax has been essentially flat since the 90s, so how do states raise money to pay for transportation projects?
There is no fee you can raise where everyone says, yeah, I'm really comfortable with paying more taxes that way. It's more of what they do, what they talk to the public about in terms of where that money's going to go.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. You are listening to the show on KJZZ. In traffic, an accident 60 eastbound at McClintock is blocking the off-ramp. Valley weather, we've kind of settled into a pattern here of partly cloudy skies and overnight lows in the mid-80s. And then for this weekend, partly cloudy skies both Saturday and Sunday. Look for a high of 106 tomorrow, 107 Sunday. And then by Monday night, slight chance of rain returns to the forecast. Currently, relative humidity is at 23%. It is mostly sunny, 99 degrees at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership featuring the all-new 2016 Outback, 33 mpg fuel efficiency and built for your active lifestyle. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
This Sunday, President Obama will travel from Kenya to Ethiopia, and when he's there, he'll become the first U.S. president to address Africa's top political group, the African Union, at his headquarters in the capital, Addis Ababa.
In an interview today with the BBC, President Obama said he will use his speech to, quote, address the continent as a whole. So it's a big deal for him and for Ethiopia, which for many people still brings to mind images of famine. It's what that country was famous for in the 1980s. But what about now? Is Ethiopia still dominated by famine and poverty, or is there a new story to tell? BBC Africa's Haiwete Haile Selassie, whose own family is from Ethiopia, says there is. Here's her report.
Ethiopia was synonymous with images from the 1980s of drought, famine, and emaciated babies.
Dawn, and as the sun breaks through the piercing chill of night on the plain outside Koram, it lights up a biblical famine, now in the 20th century. This place, say workers here, is the closest thing to hell on earth. Thousands of wasted people are coming here for help. Many find only death.
The BBC's Michael Burke reporting from the country in 1984. But that was then, and now Ethiopians are fed up of references to the famine. The East African country is about three times the size of Texas and home to almost 100 million people, the second largest population on the continent. It's one of the top 10 fastest-growing economies in the world, expanding at around 10% a year. The number of people living below the poverty line has been halved from the early 1980s to about 35%. Over the last 20 years, Ethiopia has become a staunch US ally, receiving hundreds of millions of dollars in aid and hosting US military drones that patrol East Africa. I've been a regular visitor since 1995, and Ethiopia has changed beyond recognition. In the capital, Addis Ababa, sleek new cars glide past vehicles that have been painstakingly maintained for three decades or more. You'll see tall glass and metal buildings alongside modern shopping malls, cathedrals and mosques. The government has recently invested in 13 hydroelectric dams, as well as a space observatory. Businesswoman Zemi Yunus agrees that her country has been transformed immensely in the last 15 years.
We have good roads now. We used to have only a very, very few universities in the country. Now we have many universities. We have hope now.
The government is focusing on infrastructure, but the economy remains very much based on agriculture. And like many developing economies, the gap between rich and poor is substantial, and rates of illiteracy are high. It is one of Africa's most stable countries, but there's a distinct lack of political space, and dissent is not tolerated. Ethiopia's ruling party and its allies won every single parliamentary seat in May's elections, according to official results. Opposition parties have said that the process was rigged, but the government maintained it was a free and fair election.
That was the BBC's Haywate Haile Selassie.
While President Obama and his entourage are traveling to Kenya and Ethiopia, the United States is no longer the most visible foreign presence in town. The BBC's Andrew Harding has been assessing whether American influence across the African continent is on the wane.
We're in a small village in a remote corner of mountainous Lesotho, and I've come to the local supermarket. It's owned by a Chinese couple. There's Chinese television on the screen here, and even the bread on the shelves is made in a local Chinese factory. It's a reminder of quite how profoundly China has penetrated almost every corner of this continent. What brought you here?
My relatives have been here for a few years, and they said the environment is quite all right, so I decided to move here.
What do people here think of you and think of the Chinese?
I feel that people actually respect us to a certain point because we do help out, and I think they think we are okay as people.
Open your mouth, breathe in, out.
A student has come for a consultation at an HIV/AIDS clinic in Lesotho's capital, Maseru. The virus affects close to a quarter of the population.
Okay. Can you sit?
Here, it's America rather than China that plays a key role.
My name is Edith Mohapi. I'm a pediatrician, executive director of the Baylor College of Medicine Children's Foundation, Lesotho.
When it comes to the fight against HIV/AIDS here, how important is outside help?
It's extremely important. A lot of people would have died long ago because many people in this country cannot afford antiretrovirals treatment for HIV.
And so America has played a key role.
A very key role. Even just being able to afford HIV medicines, everybody here who has HIV gets treated for free. So that's amazing.
We're in a garment factory. Hundreds of local women sitting in a freezing cold warehouse turning out tracksuit bottoms for export. This is where, if you like, American and Chinese, or in this case Taiwanese, interests coincide, because you have a lot of Chinese and Taiwanese factories which are benefiting from an American trade deal which encourages and supports manufacturing in Africa.
That is a great, great deal for us, and we are very, very appreciative.
The woman who owns this factory is from Taiwan. Her name is Jennifer Chang.
We are not the enemy. We are business people. We want to get the benefit, but we also benefit our employees. In general, I can say Chinese and Taiwanese, we contribute a lot for the society, for the country.
My name is Motebang Mokwaledi. I'm the head of planning research at LNDC. It is an investment promotion agency of Lesotho. Most of the investors that have located in Lesotho supplying the US market originate specifically from the Far East. My thinking is that the American investors do not know much about this part of the world. And I think we need to do much to try and ensure that they know about what we are, what we do.
In the meantime, the Chinese are everywhere.
They are everywhere. I think they've been very good. I think they're great explorers.
To underline that point, here, local orphans are learning Mandarin at a rural orphanage south of the capital. It's run by a Taiwanese charity. America's role here and in the wider continent remains crucial on many levels. But on the ground, it's often easy to miss it, as Far Eastern influences seep into almost every corner of Africa.
That's the BBC's Andrew Harding reporting from Africa.
Yesterday on the show, we heard from Tony Bradley, president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. He talked about the impact the bridge collapse on I-10 had on his members. He also talked about his preferred way to pay for improvements to transportation infrastructure.
What I often say about the gas tax is kind of, I paraphrase what Winston Churchill said about democracy. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government out there, except for every other form of government. And the gas tax may be the worst form of way to collect revenue for roads, but it's better than every other form out there.
But what are the other options for paying for transportation infrastructure projects? To find out, we turn to Beth Osborne, senior policy advisor for the group Transportation for America, which advocates for local transportation solutions.
The price of doing business in transportation has gone up. All the material costs and all the construction costs have gone up at the same time. Additionally, you've got some large trends going on. One is vehicles are getting more efficient, though most of the efficiencies haven't really hit the market yet. The other thing that has happened is after decades of people driving 2% more every single year, they have stopped.
How much do you think the gas tax would need to go up to account for all the projects that need to be done with some of those factors you just mentioned?
Well, I think it depends on how you define the projects that need to be done, frankly. You'll have a totally different number if you're looking at just state of repair versus everybody's dream project ever. So estimating those numbers can be very, very difficult. But we do know that we have a deficit in terms of just maintaining the infrastructure that we already have.
So for the purposes of this discussion, let's just talk about existing infrastructure that needs repair, either critical or potentially critical in the not-too-distant future. Is it fair to say that there is another way to do this other than raising the gas tax, or is that the only way to achieve that, do you think?
Definitely different ways to do this, and we're seeing different approaches at the state level. Some states, instead of a gas tax, they assign a sales tax on gasoline. In some states, they're raising other fees along with it, so it's not all coming out of the gas tax. In Oregon, they're talking about assessing a fee on the distance that people drive, as opposed to the amount of oil that they, or the gasoline that they purchase. So there's a lot of different ways you can do this. In the state of Texas, they collect money when people drill for oil on their property, and they've dedicated that funding towards transportation. You know, in some states, they've used lottery funds to help close the gap in their transportation. The way you address transportation needs can be as varied as, you know, your imagination. But there's been a tradition of trying to get as much of the program paid for by the user of the system as possible.
Have you found that of all of those methods, any seem to be more palatable to policymakers than others? Are there some that maybe somebody tried that others said, yeah, we're not going to touch that?
When folks come to my organization and ask about how we've surveyed what's going on across the country, that is the number one question. You know, which is the source of funding that gives people the most confidence, the most comfort? And it's kind of a good news, bad news story. There is no fee you can raise where everyone says, yeah, I'm really comfortable with paying more taxes that way. It's more of what they do, what they talk to the public about in terms of where that money's going to go and people's confidence in how that money will be spent. The states that have done the best, it really hasn't been that they picked that magic fee that nobody cares that they pay. It's more that they made a very good case about how the money was going to be spent. And when you look at those states that have failed to raise money, I think that they have made the exact opposite decision. They have not given the public confidence in how that money would be spent. They've either picked projects that were not inspiring to them, or that they thought were bad, or they have not been specific about how that money would be used, and people weren't willing to give more money to a program when they didn't know what they were going to get back for it.
Beth Osborne, Senior Policy Advisor with Transportation for America. Beth, thank you.
Oh, thank you. It was nice to talk to you.
The University of Arizona is usually associated with Tucson, but it has a presence all over the state, and that's expanding with a 45-acre ranch in Cornville near Sedona to be used by the U of A's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and the Veterinary Medical and Surgical Program. Shane Burgess is dean of the College of Agriculture.
Our college and our university is very, very involved in natural resource use and productivity, and also in the environmental sciences. That ranch and where it's located above the Mogollon Rim provides us an opportunity to do work directly with students and teaching, with animals, with agronomic plants and crops, with native plants and crops, with ecology, and also with local economic development. And so that's what we're doing on the teaching side, on the research side. It's the same thing in the same plants and animals. For example, we'll have cattle up there, we'll have horses up there, students will travel up there, spend periods of time up there. We'll have people from our School of Natural Resources and the Environment investigating and working on natural resources and environmental issues. It's part, of course, of the watershed that feeds Phoenix. And so it's just a small piece of land that's part of that massive watershed that feeds the Salt River Project.
Is there a plan laid out yet, Shane? Is there an idea of how many weeks a student may spend there? What sort of things the student will have to work on? And is every student potentially involved, or is this going to be sort of limited to those who really show an affinity for this?
So the answer is, in terms of high-level planning, absolutely, it's done. And the answer to this question specifically is it depends. If you're a student in natural resources or the environment in that school, some students will go and spend some time up there because whether they're grad students or undergraduate students, they'll be programmatically going in that direction. The same thing with the School of Animal and Comparative Biomedical Sciences. Not every one of those undergraduate students will go up there, but those students who are particularly interested in production animals in range environments, they'll all go up there as undergraduates. As far as the veterinary students go, the DVMs who are training, they'll all go up there for a period of up to 6 weeks where they'll be based and they'll either be working on that property with animals and doing animal medical and surgical work on that property, or they'll be distributed throughout the entire northern area of Arizona from that site.
It would seem that this sort of ranch and the location of it is more likely to experience multiple seasons, which might make it an even better place for practical uses like this. It's not just a desert environment, it's much more than that.
Oh, absolutely. 40% of the world is the kind of rangeland environment that is represented in that valley. And obviously, we're training students for more than just the desert environment in Tucson. They're going to leave Tucson, go and get jobs around the state, go and get jobs around the nation, and many of them are going to get jobs around the world. This allows us to diversify our education much more. That's why it's so important for us to have a footprint up there that we can use as flexibly as possible.
Shane Burgess, Dean of the College of Agriculture at the University of Arizona.
Coming up, the mercury is rising not only in the valley, but on the basketball court as well.
In our opinion, the best fans in the league are here in Phoenix.
How the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury have managed to capture the hearts of sports fans in the Valley? That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. With Steve, I'm Mark. Looking for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 103. It'll be partly cloudy again tonight with a low right around 84. Sunny weekend with highs tomorrow of 106, 107 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 23%, 99 degrees at 237.
KJZZ is supported by Changing Hands Bookstore, now open in Central Phoenix on the light rail at 3rd Avenue and Camelback, where you can enjoy beer, wine, and coffee while you read at First Draft Book Bar, changinghands.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. Secretary of State John Kerry continues to press for the Iran nuclear deal and warns lawmakers a vote against it will undermine the ability of President Obama to act throughout the world. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has more on Kerry's arguments.
A day after he testified before the Senate committee he once chaired, Kerry told the Council on Foreign Relations in New York that a no vote in Congress would be a major setback, and not just when it comes to inspecting Iran's nuclear program.
I mean, it's a repudiation of President Obama's initiative and a statement that when the executive department negotiates, doesn't mean anything anymore. because we have 535 secretaries of state.
That's the number of the members of the House and Senate who are now weighing in on the deal that Kerry negotiated in Vienna, along with the other permanent UN Security Council members. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama is in Kenya, where he's reuniting with his father's family. He was greeted as he stepped off Air Force One by his half-sister. It's his first visit to his father's homeland since he took office. Authorities in Lafayette, Louisiana, say they're learning more about the gunman identified as John Hauser, who fatally shot two people and wounded nine others in a crowded movie theater last night. He then turned the gun on himself. Authorities say at one point he'd been committed to a hospital for psychiatric care and kept a variety of items apparently used for disguises in his motel room. State Police Colonel Michael Edmondson is vowing to uncover his motive.
We believe in talking to the family, talking to the friends, trying to look at his writings on the internet and putting some parts and pieces together. Maybe we can try to figure out what caused him to do it.
Authorities are now investigating whether Hauser's gun was bought legally. On Wall Street, steep losses for the week. For the day, the Dow closed down 163 points. The Nasdaq slipped 57. The S&P lost 22. This is NPR.
A small San Francisco-based airline will start offering round-trip service between Sky Harbor and Sholo next month. Boutique Air was awarded the Essential Air Service contract for the route. That's a federal program that helps ensure air service to smaller communities. This is among a few such routes Boutique Air has. Sean Simpson is the carrier CEO. And Sean, who do you expect to be on these flights?
I think there's going to be a combination of traffic. Some of the people are going to be coming from Sholo to go to other places in the world. And there are plenty of people who would like to go to Sholo for any number of reasons, but certainly vacationing, I think, is a strong component there. So and as far as connecting, yeah, my guess is maybe 70 to 80% of the travelers are going to be connecting, either coming into Sholo or going out of Sholo at Sky Harbor.
Are these profitable routes? I mean, can an airline make money off these routes?
Yeah. I mean, it's in aviation, they always say, what's the best way to make $1 million in aviation? Start with $1 billion. So airlines can be very tricky, but the whole idea behind the program is that it's set up in a way so that you can and should make some type of a profit. But, you know, a couple wrong steps in aviation and you can definitely end up in a very bad position. So, you know, we try and be very careful. It's very much necessary. And I wouldn't say on any one particular route a company can make just tons and tons of money. And in a place like Sholo, it is required to have some extra money from the government, some funding, because otherwise it wouldn't be commercially viable. That much is definitely the case. And that is the point of the Essential Air Service program.
Is it possible to use these Essential Air Service routes as sort of a marketing tool, as a way to, if nothing else, let people know that your airline exists?
Absolutely. If people never fly on us or never hear about us in Sholo or Phoenix, you know, then they just don't. That's that many people that have never heard of us. If alternatively they get on our airline and they have a good experience, then it does help build a brand, for sure, and that's part of what we're doing, too.
I would think that even just having, you know, a placard up somewhere at Sky Harbor with your name on it, people walking by would say, oh, I wonder what that is, and maybe go check it out.
For sure, yeah. We recently started some flying out of Denver, going into some small towns in Nebraska, and right on the freeway, on your way to Denver International, you've got all these airlines listed. You know, you've got Virgin and Delta and United, and then there's Boutique Air, too. So it's, you know, how much is that worth, and how many people are going to go look us up? Maybe not too many people, but it doesn't hurt for building the brand.
Sean Simpson is CEO of Boutique Air. The carrier will start offering flights between Phoenix and Sholo on August 1st. Sean, thanks.
Well, hey, thank you so much for having me.
Serving smaller communities with airline service is a national requirement, but according to aviation expert Robert Mittelstadt, the costs in Arizona can really stand out.
Depending on the market size, the larger airline wants to have a feeder into their system,
But in markets that are very small, in the case of Sholo, the government, federal government, currently subsidizes Sholo, and they meet a very low bar of having only 10 arrivals and departures of passengers per day. Most of the people that then form these small boutique airlines to serve individual communities usually have some relationship or interest or a broken heart for the community that they're serving.
Do you think the subsidizing makes sense to make sure that these smaller markets are served?
I don't think so. Let me give you a couple of statistics. There are currently about 825 airports in the United States with commercial air service. Of those, 163 of them are subsidized. They're subsidized under a law that came out of airline deregulation. When airlines were deregulated in 1978, there were subsidies provided to smaller airports to ensure that the airlines didn't immediately dump the smaller airports. Mm-hmm. And they had a 12-year period from 1978 to 1990 where basically the airlines had to keep flying to all the places they were flying before deregulation, except that they got paid extra to do it. After 1990, the airlines aren't required to maintain those services any longer, but the communities have to apply and meet certain characteristics in order to be eligible for the subsidies. And because the costs kept going up, the Congress capped the program. And so now the number of 163 are those that are left. And if one of those drops out because they no longer meet criteria, there won't be others added to fill it up. Mm. We spend out of the federal budget $241 million this year to subsidize those 163 airports. And in fact, in Arizona, the airports that receive subsidies are Kingman, Page, Prescott, and Sholo. And Sholo, at a subsidy of $589 per passenger per trip, is in the top five or six nationally in terms of the amount that they are subsidized.
Bob, is there anything unique or interesting about the timing of this boutique airline going into Sholo?
Under a new interpretation of the law, next year, the original law said that the airlines had to be held to, or the communities could get no more than a $200 per person per trip subsidy. And the Department of Transportation has said that a year or so from now, they're going to look back at the 2015 data and they're going to review airports that are getting more subsidy than that and look at the specifics and consider their cases and may begin to disallow them. Mm. So I suspect the handwriting is on the wall for Sholo and that there are people that understand that they will probably lose that program funding.
Aviation expert Bob Mittelstadt, he's also the former dean of ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Bob, thank you.
Great to talk to you, Steve.
Organizations and communities around the country are getting involved with public storytelling events. That includes KJZZ's participation in the Arizona Storytellers Project. Humans have told stories to each other in groups for thousands of years. The return to that face-to-face approach may have something to do with our increasing reliance on gadgets and social media. In a few minutes, we'll learn about the science of stories. First, I'm joined by Liz Warren, who is director of the Storytelling Institute at South Mountain Community College. Liz, you deal with a diverse group of students, but do they ultimately arrive at the power of storytelling in similar ways?
I really believe that over the years, the most radical work that we have done happens in our Art of Storytelling classes, and it's because of that diversity. Mm-hmm. 20 people come into a room that would have never met each other before. We have African Americans, Native Americans, Latinos, farm kids from Levine. We have basketball players. We have women returning to college, businessmen who may have stopped in to bump up their skills. And they all come into the classroom and they share traditional stories, folk tales and myths. And they move on to fact-based stories, family stories, stories about other people that they know or maybe that they admire. And then finally, after they've built up all that trust over the semester, they tell their personal stories. And by the end of that 16 weeks, or if it's in the summer, maybe 8 weeks, those people have become a community. And they've learned things about other people, other cultures that they wouldn't have learned otherwise.
Liz, do they all feel like they really have a story to tell, whether about themselves or someone else, or does it take a little bit of time for them to feel like, oh, yeah, I guess this is as interesting as this other person?
We have all sorts of techniques to help people find those personal stories, or those stories about a grandparent or a significant person in their life, or an event that impacted them or their community. And once we identify that, we help them craft it, help them practice and tell it. And then, of course, we build an environment in the classroom that fosters the trust and support for them to be able to tell that in a safe way.
What are some elements that come to mind for you that make it seem like these sorts of projects are really taking off, that there is a desire for more people to get involved in these? It's not just a special conference or a special event every once in a while. These are regular things that regular, average people who may not be able to tell stories in their careers as we do in radio or in media, what's making it take off?
I think there's two things that come especially to mind. And one is that this is an ancient thing. It's fresh now because it's been suppressed for whatever reason for the last 100 years or so. We've been caught up in movies and television and even radio dramas. Mm-hmm. And that really took the place of the kind of story sharing and oral traditional storytelling that would have been really present in all of our communities, 100, certainly 200 years ago. But this last few years, the last 4 or 5 years, people getting together to share their own personal experiences, that is fresh and at the same time ancient. And I think it has to do in part because we are so attached to our devices. We can start to feel isolated. I love my device as much as anyone, believe me. But I do think that people can feel that they've spent too much time in front of a screen and having virtual experiences instead of real experiences. And I think it has created a need for us to join with other people face to face and hear about their lives and share these stories.
Is there a possibility this is a wall breaker in some ways, to knock down some walls and say, okay, we may disagree about this, but boy, when you told that story, it really connected with me.
What happens in these nights of live storytelling is that the stories are reflecting universal human problems that transcend cultural differences. Mm-hmm. So that allows us to see that person as a human just like us. And while we may not have had that same experience, let's say it's an experience of a loss of a family member. Maybe it didn't happen for us in that way, but we've lost family members. So we know what that's like. So we see that person as a human being rather than as a representative of his or her culture.
Liz Warren, director of the Storytelling Institute at South Mountain Community College. Kendall Haven is a storyteller and author who has looked into the science of stories. He says our minds are set up to absorb and appreciate those stories.
It is the way our brains are wired. That's why we resonate so to story. It's because information provided in what we call a good story matches exactly the informational demands of your brain when it tries to make sense out of incoming information.
What is the difference when someone is in an audience with 50 other people watching a storyteller? And if I were to sit at my home computer and watch the same story being told, but I'm sitting by myself in the room, what is the different reaction of the brain to that?
The word storytelling has two parts.
Okay.
Story is a noun. It's a physical thing. Telling is a verb. It's an interactive process. There hasn't been nearly as much research into the telling half. There's massive amounts of anecdotal information and some qualitative information that's what I'll share with you right now. But it pales by comparison to what's been done in the story half, because that's where we can really look at the wiring of the brain and watch your brain on story. As part of a research project that I was doing over the last couple of years, I was delivering a story live to audiences. They were wired with EEG, 24-channel EEG equipment, and a number of other monitoring systems. Plus, we did before and after interviews with those audience members. I was able to take people who were not pick to be in the audience and one-on-one tell them the exact same stories and at least do the pre-post interview part. So I was getting self-reported answers consistently. The people who were in the audience reported a more intense residual emotion. That is to say, at the end of the story, they felt their experience of the story more powerfully, and the emotions that they felt were stronger and more vivid than were those who got the exact same story one-on-one. Why has that happened? Well, we're back into theory. I suspect it has a lot to do with the fact that for 150,000 years before there was writing, we relied on storytelling to communicate these essential bits of information, and that somehow our brains are attuned and programmed to key into the group reaction.
Kendall Haven is a master storyteller and author. He's the author of more than 30 books, including Story Smart, Using the Science of Story to Inspire, Persuade, Influence, and Teach, and Story Proof, The Science Behind the Startling Power of Story. Kendall, thanks so much for the insights. Great talking with you.
And thank you. It was a pleasure.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Quick check of traffic. 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at 24th Street. I-17 southbound, an accident at Peoria. And the 101 southbound, an accident at Shea.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments and D.N. Griebel in their Mesa branch. Moores & Cabot is a 125-year-old national wealth management firm that is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC.
The Phoenix Mercury are once again one of basketball's hottest teams as they look to defend their title this summer. The Mercury will have three players in this weekend's WNBA All-Star Game. Guard Candace Dupree, center Brittany Griner, and forward DeWanna Bonner will represent them tomorrow in Connecticut. KJZZ's Phil Latzman explored how their success in Phoenix has become a model for women's professional sports franchises everywhere.
Phoenix may be the Valley of the Sun, but it's also the land of the mighty Mercury. Phoenix is home to the three-time and defending WNBA champion Mercury, one of the most successful franchises in the history of women's pro sports. While baseball's Diamondbacks are playing the Giants just blocks away, a sellout crowd is settling in for a Saturday night home game against the New York Liberty. Mercury general manager Jim Pittman credits their long-term success to what the team calls the X Factor.
In our opinion, the best fans in the league are here in Phoenix. They support us on and off the court. Winning or losing, they're always here, they're always loud.
As evidence, the Mercury leads the league in attendance, averaging nearly 10,000 fans a night. Many have come to see Brittany Griner. At 6'8" and over 200 pounds, she's the most dominant physical presence in the league, averaging over 4 block shots per game. And as if that attention weren't enough, she's gotten even more of it off the court. Griner and her now ex-wife, Glory Johnson, who played for the rival Tulsa Shock, were each suspended 7 games earlier this season, the heaviest penalty ever handed down by the WNBA, after police were called to their Goodyear home in April following a physical confrontation. The 24-year-old Griner says she now has a new perspective.
It made me appreciate basketball more, sitting out those 7 games, and it just made me, you know that this, I don't ever want to do anything that's going to jeopardize, you know, what I love to do.
Mercury fan Teresa Graves proudly sports a Brittany Griner t-shirt showcasing her signature dreadlocks.
She's a really nice person. She takes the time out for the kids and you know, she's just a great athlete.
Griner's boss, Mercury head coach Sandy Brondello, says the organization also stands solidly behind her.
She's learned from that mistake. She's moved forward. I mean, we all have. And look, basketball is her haven, and this is where, you know, it's what she does. It's what she loves to do. Look, she's a great player. She's going to be one of the greatest players ever, and she keeps getting better.
And that means the franchise will keep getting better with her. That is, if she isn't lured away for more money. It's something that just happened to former teammate Diana Taurasi. After leading the Mercury to last year's title, Taurasi was given $1.5 million by a Russian team to sit out this WNBA season. Reiner, who makes about $47,000 a year in Phoenix, earns 12 times more playing in China in the league's offseason. Brondello hopes salaries will soon be as attractive to women's players in the WNBA as they were to men playing in the NBA.
We hope so. I mean, I think that's the goal. But look, we have to put it in perspective. The NBA, it took them a long time to get the salaries that they did. Really, in professional sports, we're still a young sport.
Ann Myers Drysdale, a Basketball Hall of Famer, is the Mercury's vice president and a team broadcaster.
I absolutely see the league improving and the salaries improving. Billie Jean King started it with tennis and what she's done for the tennis tournaments, and Serena getting the same amount of money that the guys are getting. And then the fact that you've got the World Cup and what the women did in the World Cup. At some point, there's got to be a lot of pressure. The WNBA and the salaries taken a little bit more seriously as far as what they're making.
Myers Drysdale, who helped construct the team's three championship seasons and was the first pick in the now defunct WBL, the original Women's Professional Basketball League, started in the 80s, says the WNBA is well ahead of where the NBA was in its ascent.
We're by far way ahead of that. It took them 30 years before kind of things turned around for them. And, you know, we've got a great fan base, and people can continue to say that we're a fledgling league, but we're not. We're here to stay.
And it appears so are the fans in the Valley of the Sun for the mighty Mercury. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News in Phoenix.
And if basketball isn't your thing, plenty of other good stuff to do around town this weekend, including, I think, Steve, I found what you and I should be doing this weekend.
I think I know it.
The Showdown yes. Arm Wrestling Tournament tomorrow night at the Trough in Mesa.
That's starting early, Mark. That's starting at about 90 seconds, my friend. Once we go off the air,
off
it's
the
over.
Air, yes. You would totally take me down. I have no chance.
No. You're a loving person. The Sugar Thieves are playing tonight at 8 at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. A little blues music.
Also, the Diamondbacks host the Milwaukee Brewers this weekend at Chase Field downtown.
And the New Works Westival continues at the Peoria Center for the Performing Arts as part of Theater Works Summerfest.
The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
And if you've got any great ideas for stories or other things, contact us, theshow@kjzz.org. All Things Considered is up next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great weekend. It is 3 o'clock.